The exhibition starts very quietly in this first room with a noisy thing called percussion. And as you go through the show, you'll notice it gets bigger, louder, and more media. So why would you have John Cage in an art museum? That's the first question many people think of. And the reason is, for us with this exhibition, is that he changed the definition of what it is to be a composer. One of the great authors on John Cage, named James Pritchett, spoke about, in the beginning of his book, he protested that he wanted people to understand that John Cage was above all a composer. So he gets called a philosopher and all these other titles that we think of because he changed a lot of the thinking in the late 20th century. But fundamentally what he changed is, if we still call him a composer, what he changed is what that means to be a composer. So suddenly the apparatus for composing, which is the score, became available to many other people who weren't in music, particularly to artists. So that's what this show concerns itself with, the definition of the composer, how we can trace it through the scores. And you'll notice through the exhibition that Cage's scores change radically. So in this room we have pretty conventional looking scores on 5-line staff notation. A few galleries later you're going to have grids and graphs and transparencies and diagrams, and above all language. So we start in this room with the earliest part of Cage's career. The beginning of Cage's career, which starts in 1939, his first professional scale compositions, and they're for percussion music. Now, some of you may or may not know, Cage's father was an inventor. He invented extraordinary things like turbines for submarines, things like that. And funnily enough, what he invented for the submarine made bubbles and noise, so that the Navy didn't want it for, you know, top secret military exercise. But he was constantly inventing, and I think that's what he gave to Cage. Cage said that his great aspiration, if people are going to take anything from his work, it would be some quality of discovery. So we see that when he gets to writing scores for which any outcome might be possible, the listener is a discoverer along with the composer. So here, already in the moment that he's composing for percussion music, he starts adding strange instruments. He said he was interested in more new sounds. Okay, so we think of the futurists like Luigi Russolo and the art of noise. Cage knew about all this, of course, and he's in Los Angeles, California, expanding it from his own perspective. He develops a percussion ensemble and performs up and down the West Coast in the beginning of his career. And he begins to teach in Seattle, in a place called the Cornish School in Seattle. He gets hired as an instructor, but also an accompanist to the dance. So he has to put the music to the dance. And this is very important for how his work develops. So what you have here, in this case, are two of the earliest scores by Cage. One is called First Construction in Metal, and it uses all these sort of odd instruments, as I said, parts of a car, the middle of a tyre, it's called a brake drum, something called a thunder sheet, which is this big piece of metal that you shake and it makes an extraordinary noise, anvils, it's like a hammer. So all these sort of funny things that he adds to the realm of percussion, which makes it start to sound very different and very unexpected. Then we also see here his first score called Imaginary Landscape. Now this is a beautiful metaphor for Cage, because he was always looking out onto a new landscape of possibility for composition. And all his imaginary landscape scores, they run through his career for about a decade and a half, a series of 5 or 6 scores, all concerned with technology, whatever that technology was at the time. So this one, number one, is written in 1939, and the technology then was phonograph records. Okay, so he plays frequency sounds on phonographic records. That was very technologically advanced for that moment. And he puts that into the score. You'll see the others as we go through the show. But so this is the beginning. And percussion is the thing for which he receives his first fame and notoriety. He comes to New York and stays with Peggy Guggenheim and Max Ernst, and he thinks about doing a percussion performance. Now, interestingly enough, he's very good operator, Cage. He's very ambitious, and he knows what he wants. So even at this stage, he manages to get himself a gig at the Museum of Modern Art. And that's covered in Life magazine, which you see here. Of course, Peggy Guggenheim is technically the opposition to MoMA. So she gets very angry that because she wants to give him a percussion concert, and she offers to pay for his instruments to come from California, or Chicago, actually. And when she finds out he got a performance at MoMA, she says she kicks him out of her house and says she's not paying for anything. And Cage arrived in New York with exactly 47 cents in his pocket. So he was crying because he was homeless and couldn't move his instruments and all this. So this is one of these lovely anecdotes about his early career. But anyway, the Life magazine thing came out and gave him a lot of attention. They said he was 30 years old. They said this 30-year-old from California has come here and he's changing the world of music. Okay? So that's the percussion moment. In Seattle, before he actually comes to New York, when he's teaching and accompanying the dance, he discovers that there's not enough space on stage for the dancers and for all his percussion instruments. So this is very crucial. This is the moment he invents the prepared piano. And he says that with the prepared piano, he has a percussion orchestra under the control of a single player. And so he can have just one piano rather than a lot of things on stage, and he can make way for the dance. Okay, so necessity breeded invention. And these are his preparations. And one of the oldest, earliest boxes that still remain of all his preparations. And you see the instructions for where to place all the pieces amid the strings of the piano. It's very beautiful. It says distance from bridge, 2¼ inches. Like he measured the Steinway model of piano exactly. He was very meticulous, or as Margaret has said, manic obsessive or something. So
obsessive compulsive.
this score behind here represents his first prepared piano score. It's called Bacchanal, and it's a very beautiful story. There was a dancer in Seattle, an African-American woman, which is pretty unusual to be a grand choreographer already in 1940 as a black woman. So she composes a dance called Bacchanal, and Cage tries to do the music with his percussion and then starts playing around with the piano and realizing he can alter the sound and invent something. Now, he had two very important teachers, Arnold Schoenberg and Henry Cowell. What Henry Cowell gave to him was a concept already called the string piano. So Cage wasn't the first to open the lid of the piano and use the strings. And Cage took quite a while to admit this because the prepared piano was really his invention. So it's not until the sort of mid to late 50s that he starts speaking really about Henry Cowell giving him the credit for this string piano. So everyone comes from somewhere. He's not on his own with that. So then the exhibition here moves to the first treatment of Cage's engagement with modern artists. And this painting is a very extraordinary special painting made in 1943 for an exhibition that was dedicated to chess, called The Imagery of Chess. And he sort of, I think it was arranged by Marcel Duchamp and Max Ernst, but I think Cage really did it in honour of Duchamp. And so it's extraordinary. It sort of combines the idea of a chessboard with the idea of a musical score. And so these notes are sort of composed in the structure of a chessboard. Now, it wasn't until very, very recently that this lady here, Margaret Lang Tan, discovered that you could play this. So you could play the painting like a score. So it's sort of a miracle. It's both a painting and a musical score. and it's sort of 70 years old now, and the notes are coming off the painting, so it's an incredible fragile object, and we were very lucky to get it. But this shows you Cage's first thought about Duchamp and his love for Duchamp. Duchamp, as you probably know, other than being a brilliant modern artist, was also a chess master. So this was a sort of mutual admiration thing. So just a few years after that, Cage is asked to do the music for this part of a film which has Duchamp's roto-reliefs in it. So they're Duchamp's images, and Cage did a prepared piano piece that goes along with this. The film was made by the Dada artist Hans Richter, and it's called Dreams That Money Can Buy. Now, what's so beautiful about Cage and Duchamp coming together in this is that Duchamp's roto-reliefs were what he called anti-retinal. Duchamp was rejecting traditional painting, retinal being the pleasure we get from brush strokes and beautiful colour combination, simultaneous contrast of colours, things like that. So he did something that confused the eye and tricked the eye against all that old-fashioned painting. And he meets up with someone who's changing everything about music. So it's an ideal match there. Now this gallery, the way we sort of map it is from prepared piano to chance. What you have in this corner is another engagement with a modern artist with Cage, which is Alexander Calder. It's a film called Works of Calder. And this is all the sort of scoring and timing Cage did to match the music to the film. So it's just to sort of open out Cage a little bit. Everyone knows Rauschenberg and all those later connections with artists, but not many people know that the earlier big figures of modern art he was already working with and collaborating with and thinking from a perspective as art as well as music. So this is important if you're going to have Cage in an art museum to sort of make these bigger connections. Now the grand magnum opus for prepared piano is a piece called Sonatas and Interludes, which is on the wall behind. And the exact preparations for that piece are represented in the piano here. Again, placed by the expert in the world, Margaret Langtan. So she came from New York to prepare the piano for us, amongst other performances. In any case, Sonatas and Interludes is a very interesting moment for Cage because he's doing several prepared piano pieces at a very difficult time in his life in the mid-1940s. He leaves his wife and he starts having a relationship with Merce Cunningham. And to be gay in New York in 1940 was like a nightmare. So he's hiding a lot. He's trying to sort of... He's in the closet, but in his music, he's unbelievably passionate. And all these passions and anxieties and everything are coming out in the music. And so a couple of pieces in that gallery... If you get time to go back and listen, there's The Perilous Night, and there's another one called In the Name of the Holocaust. Unbelievably using the word Holocaust 3 years before the Second World War ends, 1942. It's very dramatic, dark, strong, prepared piano music. And what he discovers with The Perilous Night, he gets really upset because he puts all this emotion into the music, and he realises no one gets it. No one could possibly know all the kind of passion that he's put into it. The audience doesn't get it. So then he decides, right, no emotion, none of me in the music, right? He has to get above the level of the personal. And so Sonatas and Interludes, he discovers Indian philosophy and aesthetics. He meets a woman called Gita Sarabhai who teaches him Indian philosophy in exchange for classes on Western music. And she gives him several important books. I won't give you all the details now unless you want them. And one deals with, in Indian philosophy, something called the 9 permanent emotions. And these are sort of, you know, sorrow, anger, envy, you know, lust, all these sort of, you know, sort of existential emotions. but they're not Cage's emotions, right? They're a philosophical level of emotion. So he can put that into the sonatas and interludes without having expressed himself. This is a very important moment when he gives up on self-expression. The very next step to giving up on self-expression is chants, using chants. Okay, so this is a turning point, 1946 to 48. Now, before we move on to the grand work of chants, which is on the other wall, there's a little interlude here, which is Marcel Duchamp. Marcel Duchamp is the father of chants in the 20th century, and he's the father of turning art conceptual, right? He invents the ready-made, he invents all these things that aren't to do with an old-fashioned way of painting, drawing, all those sort of more traditional things in art. So this score here is a score written in 1913, made totally from chants. Duchamp works with his two sisters, who are musicians, Magdalene and Yvonne, and they pull notes out of a hat, A, B, C, D, E, F, out of a hat, and they make this music by chance, pulling the notes out of the hat. So that probably stands as the first chance musical composition of the 20th century. Just a year, like within the same year, he makes this work by chance, which is called the Three Standard Stoppages. What this is Duchamp said was his joke on the meter, but he was kind of too modest. It's much even more interesting than that. Duchamp was fighting convention all the time. Whatever convention there was, in anything he saw, he tried to fight it. So the funny thing about the meter is, since it was invented in France, this unit of measurement, you know, it's sort of revered like a god. Wow, that's a meter. You know, you can go and see the meter in this sort of chapel-like place in France. So Duchamp was, you know, a little bit making a joke on that. So what he did with this is he got 3-metre-long pieces of string, held them up a metre high, dropped them on the floor. When they fell, they didn't fall straight, right? They fell like... And so he glued them to these canvases in the configurations in which they fell. He said with this he'd redefined the metre. Okay, he's got 3 new cases of the metre. And since none of them are straight, but they're all still a metre, he had to then make 3 rulers to define the new metre. So, and when he was asked who made this work, how did this work come about, he very famously said, "I'm not the author of this work. The author is chance." So it's a landmark. In the next couple of years, Duchamp, I have to sort of let myself out of the closet here. I'm a diehard Duchamp fan. I love Duchamp because I think he really changed everything, and Cage saw a lot in him which made Cage move as well. Anyway, so these 3 works here are little photographs by Duchamp, but they're all to do with very contingent sort of things. Like the middle one is dust on the surface of one of his works. It's called Dust Breeding on the Large Glass, 1919. And the one on the right is about shadows. He has his ready-mades in his studio, and he takes a photograph of the shadows of the ready-made on the wall. And this is to point to the contingent status and meaning of the ready-made, that it matters whether it's in an art museum or in the street or wherever the object is, it gains meaning by its context. Okay, so if you just get the shadow, you reflect its contingent status. And why I think this is particularly good, relevant for Cage, is because when we get into the next gallery, you'll see Rauschenberg's white paintings, and Cage called this, the white paintings, an airport for dust and shadows. So Duchamp beat him to it by about 50 years. Anyway, so now we get on to Cage's grand work for chants, which is The Music of Changes. It's called The Music of Changes because he used a very famous book to make it, the I Ching Book of Changes. It's called the I Ching Book of Changes. That book has 64 hexagrams, and you toss coins to arrive at one number. And then you look it up and you get the hexagram and you work out the meaning for whatever question you're asking that book. So in this case, Cage would say sound or silence, loud or soft, you know, all the parts of the music, and he made every decision by chance. It's a lot of decisions if you look at that score. and right here you've got, these are original notes from the Getty in California of all Cage's working out of this piece. So you have sounds, durations, dynamics, all the parts of the score. And he worked this out with David Tudor. So it's dedicated to David Tudor. David Tudor was an incredible virtuoso pianist. And unbelievably enough, he followed Cage into the de-skilling of music. So, but he did everything with him. And Cage really wrote everything for David Tudor for a period of 15 years because he was like his partner in crime. So many really great pianists just rejected Cage. They said, I'm not doing that, chance stuff, you know. So Tudor was very loyal and really taking it all very seriously, and he helped make it fly, make it into a reality. So just one last work in this room that's important, which is a very, very precious and grand piece by Robert Rauschenberg from 1949. This is just to say that before Rauschenberg met Cage, he was dealing with radical things that would make them agree with each other when they finally met, right? So this is called, this is a print work he made at Black Mountain. It's a flip book. You flip the pages and the image changes. And it's called, it's a long title. This is the first half of a print designed to exist in passing time. And so what's inside, you see this little square. We can't open the book anymore because it'll fall apart. It's 1949. But that square represents that. So Rauschenberg did a woodblock print with a black. And then he did one line, two lines, all the way to almost white. It's almost like a photographic scale, black to white, right? But it's about making a work of art in time that moves through time. So it's a sort of landmark for Rauschenberg. So this section of the gallery behind me deals with this extraordinary experimental college in North Carolina called Black Mountain College. And Cage and Cunningham go there twice, once in 1948 and once in 1952. In 1948, Cage gives his extraordinary iconoclastic lectures against Beethoven and in favour of Satie, Eric Satie. So he gives a lecture called A Defense of Satie. And there he says Beethoven's destroyed music, basically. His harmonic scale versus the rhythmic scale of Satie is deathly to music, he thinks. So, and there was all these German immigrants teaching at the college, so you can imagine it wasn't very popular. but at the same time, Buckminster Fuller, the visionary, you know, he's sort of an inventor, an architect, all these things at once. He's making models of the possibility of future buildings or spanning spaces architecturally with the least materials covering the most space. So he's thinking about issues that we think about only today, sustainability, the environment, all these things. So he was a huge influence on Cage to turn Cage's work in an ethical direction. You know, in the beginning, Cage is just changing music. Then with Fuller, he sees that if you change everything about something, about one discipline, you can change the world. So his aspirations have this extraordinary model of Fuller. And I also think the model itself as a thing is a very romantic thing, right? Because it looks to a realm of possibility. It's a model of what might be able to be done, right? So in this sense, it's like a score that relates to a performance. The model relates to a building, right? So there's this utopian dimension in which Fuller and Cage were very much parallel. This is Cage's first score for his most famous piece ever, 4:33, 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Now, what I thought was very important in this exhibition is to give people a better idea about this score, because it's a big mystery. People don't really know what to make of it. They also don't have a very clear definition of what Cage meant by silence, which doesn't mean no sound. So there's all these sort of unravelling of the mystery that I wanted to do by presenting all the versions of this score. Everyone thinks it's just one thing. It's actually, he wrote three versions of the score. The first one's in very traditional notation, right? Again, it's on the old paper. And what he does is just put the brackets with nothing inside, right? So they're just temporal brackets. The scores contemporaneous with this tell us much more about this than the sort of conceptual object 4:33 has become. So the other score he wrote at exactly the same time is called Imaginary Landscape Number 4. You might remember that I told you the imaginary landscape scores are about technology. So this one's a composition for 12 radios. You know, up, down, tuning, volume, making sound with the radios. Of course, it's got some chance in it because you might not have any signal, or you might have only 1.5 seconds in which to do something. So it's sort of trying to be creative with this sort of monstrous thing, the radio. I mean, Cage, radios, he hated radios. They annoyed him. And so he tried to deal with the things that were disrupting the experience of listening and make you a creative person with this new technology, show you how to live with it, basically. What I have just sort of discovered in the process of this show is that I think this was a bit of an iconoclastic sort of dig at Arnold Schoenberg, right? Because Schoenberg has the 12 tones in his music, and Cage chose exactly 12 radios. You know, very Oedipal in a way. And then Nam June Paik, when he has his television show in 63, chooses 12 televisions. So it's like this sort of system of killing the father with something more, you know, advanced and stranger. So, but what's important here in this context, this is on traditional music paper too, right? So right now we're still in the realm of the five-line staff notation. In the same year, you suddenly get a graphic score that no longer has musical notes on it. This is Williams Mix, and then Imaginary Landscape Number 5. He also does this beautiful score called Water Music, and this is a score that is made like a poster so that the pianist turns it round and the whole audience can see it. It's the first time Cage is like, why should the composer be the only one who sees the score? Right? He's democratizing the score by letting everyone see it. So this is where his scores start to change and become more radical. For those of you who are music people, the missing link, this one of the secrets why they change so much in this moment is because his colleague Morton Feldman writes a graphic score. It's called Progression Number 1. And Cage is like, oh my God, he beat me to it. So there's this sort of little tussle with Morton Feldman. And because Cage is thinking along these lines and he has a much more complex philosophical project behind it, but this guy just gets in first with one graphic score and then maybe doesn't take it too much further. But so Cage had to catch up very quickly. So we're going to look at this and then come back, because I'm a very chronological person. Now the second version of 4:33 is this. So this is like, if there's one thing you take away from this talk that you'll know more than anyone else after this, is that that 4:33 is a mobile and hybrid conceptual object. It's not one thing. So when he first thinks about it, it's on musical notation. He sees Rauschenberg's white paintings and he rewrites it in linear It's called space-time notation. 1/8 of an inch equals 1 second. Okay, so it's a spatial object now. And if you look at it for a little while, you'll recognise that the lines in the score sort of echo the abutments of the paintings, the panels, the white panels, the gaps in between. So this is like the three movements of 4:33. And this is where, see, if we stand in front of it, it catches what's going on in the room, right? So Cage very romantically said, this is an airport for dust and shadows. And what's beautiful is, so here's the explanation of 4:33 for those who don't fully know at this point. It's an envelope into which lots of things can be dropped. At the same time, Cage gives a lecture, or a year earlier, and he says, think of a glass into which anything can be poured, right? So 4:33 is just spaces of time, and the silence is a silencing of the composer, of the authorial arrogance to say, I'm going to tell you what to hear. And he suddenly gives people the opportunity to be listeners themselves and to hear every sound in the world. And what the score does is like a frame, it focuses you. It focuses your listening. So silence is just a relative term. It just means the composer's not doing anything. Okay? So it's interesting. This is very important because Cage kind of theorises his project along with the artists. Rauschenberg's white paintings have become a lot more interesting because of what Cage said about them. Okay? So actually, I'm going to embarrass Rauschenberg here. But what Rauschenberg first said when he made it was something religious and spiritual. He said, you know, he was making paintings with white and he used the word God quite often. And then he said, these paintings today is their creator. So he was thinking in a really funny religious way. And Cage said, no, that's not what they are. They're airports for dust and shadow. So he changed the whole idea of what these paintings meant. So then, like, this is 1951. 53, they start working together. And so the tire print is a sort of, think of it as an anti-Jackson Pollock, because it's non-expression, right? Pollock is all about expression as well as chance. This tire print is about removing that expression and still making a work of art. Okay, so I don't know if you know how it was made. Basically, Cage had a Model T Ford, and he drove it, and Rauschenberg put ink, black ink, on the tyres and put the paper down. And so it's a communal work. They did it together. So this is the tyre print. The music box is a beautiful sort of combination between Cage and Duchamp in Rauschenberg's work. Rauschenberg sees a Dada show in New York organised by Duchamp, and he says, oh, and there's a work by Duchamp where you shake it, and it's called With Hidden Noise, right? So Rauschenberg makes this. It's got little stones inside, and you're meant to shake it and use it as a musical instrument. Apparently, when Duchamp saw this object a couple of years later, he looked at it and said, I think I've heard that tune before. So I don't know, one more thing I just want to tell you about this gallery is we've done something pretty unusual with the history of Cage's engagement with artists. Everyone knows something about Cage and Rauschenberg. No one knows about Ellsworth Kelly. Ellsworth Kelly is an American artist who, you might know his work, it's very abstract now. It's abstract shapes. But he starts off with a kind of a chance drawing. He's using not Cagean chance but surrealism. So he does sort of automatism. Then he moves on and makes this very funny painting called Toilette, which is a toilet, you know, that you stand over, these horrible things in cafes in Paris. Kelly's a figurative painter at this point. We're talking 1949, 1950. Cage comes to Paris to see Pierre Boulez, and he comes and sees Kelly. And Kelly shows him this painting. He says, oh, pretty good, interesting. You know, because he's basically trying to use a structure from the world, just as Cage is, right? But Kelly can't resist anthropomorphizing it, turning it back into a figure, right? So he puts a little neck and little arms on it. So it's a toilet with a body and arms kind of thing. He's not quite there yet. And then the next thing he does, amazingly, in these notebooks, is he thinks of the idea of all white paintings, exactly like Rauschenberg's. Same year, same moment. One is in Paris, one is in New York. So actually, Cage tells Kelly, you might want to go and see Robert Rauschenberg when he comes back to New York. Kelly's like, oh, you know, they did the same thing. It's a very dramatic moment in art history. So Kelly thinks of the all-white paintings. Then he goes from that toilette that is a little figurative to painting exactly what's in the world, which is the pavement. It's like cement in a courtyard in Paris. And this still looks a little like it could be a distilled painting, like a Van Tongelu or a Mondrian or something. So he hasn't quite succeeded in fully making something that just feels like a tattoo of the world. Anyway, this last one is here because it's drawn from a Japanese screen that Cage found in a flea market in Paris. And it's like this Japanese shoji screen, and Kelly just makes a painting out of the screen, and it's exactly what it was. So this is called White Relief, and Kelly dedicates it to Cage. So somehow by talking to Cage, it moved Kelly's work on to a point where he could become the great figure of abstraction that he's become. So in this 1958 to 1960, Cage invents a new concept. It's called indeterminacy. And with that, he converts the score into something more like a tool. So instead of having the whole thing written out before you, you've got parts of a score to build your own outcome. Okay, so he starts using transparencies, and each represents a part of the music, and you combine them however you want. So for those of you who know Fluxus, which we'll get to in a minute, this is like the beginning of that idea of the score and Fluxus and do-it-yourself art, right? So Cage does it with music. First one's Variations 1. Soon thereafter, he does one in Milan called Fontana Mix. For a bit of trivia, the landlady where he was living was called Signora Fontana, so he named it after her. Anyway, this is like a strange and complex score, but it starts with squiggly lines, and you put the dots on top. I wonder if I can show you. You start just with that, right? Then you add the dots and you line them up. Then you need a grid to map it. So you have a grid, and then you join the dots with the line, and you have your composition. So each part represents a different pitch, duration, you know, all these things, and you make your own. So this is indeterminacy. And Cage had sort of developed a concept called experimental composition. And he was very sure to say, this does not mean that composer doesn't know what they're doing, just because we call it experimental. It means that we make a form and the outcome is unknown. So this is experimental composition moves to indeterminacy. Very beautifully, he writes these scores in Italy as well. First, this is Milan and this is Venice, Sounds of Venice. But he writes a score called Water Walk, and it suddenly becomes very theatrical. Now, something I didn't tell you earlier, but the impact of dance on Cage was that I believe that he saw that the visual was being more important than the auditory. It was a more powerful art. So as you see through his career, he gets more theatrical. So that the things he does, he's not just doing music anymore. Because a performance like this on stage is very funny, very entertaining. It's a piece called Water Walk. He has a bathtub, flowers, he makes himself a scotch, drinks it, you know, turns on a blender, hits the radio, and does all these things, but they're all actions, right? And they suddenly make an avant-garde piece of music worth the attention of a lot more people than just the music audience. So if you ask the question, why did Cage become so big? so important. It's because he broke into other fields, right? And he made his music matter on a visual level, on a performance level, on a theatrical level. And so his ideas could be represented in a much larger way, essentially. And very importantly, he went on television. Now, this is crucial. It's like dealing with mass media, right? In 1959-60. It's kind of unbelievable. And a little bit of an irony about indeterminacy is that he always wore a beautiful suit and did it absolutely perfectly, practiced so he could get it in 3 minutes without a mistake. Going around stage. And so you look at quite a few different performances of water music, and they're all quite similar. And you think, how can indeterminacy make two things that are similar, right? It's because Cage said you can't mess up indeterminacy. No one will know what it is, right? He had to do it very perfectly, even to get his point across. Okay, so this is indeterminacy. So the two places he did it were on TV and also in art galleries. He goes to Darmstadt and gives a dramatic lecture, but then goes to an art gallery in Dusseldorf to perform it, because no concert hall wants him to do that in the concert hall. The Germans got very angry at him. So why Cage in an art museum? Because he's always having to do his work in an art context, because the avant-garde art audience is more sympathetic. So this is Cage in Europe doing these performances. These are scores that get more and more radical. Above the case there, you have a famous score called 000, which he also called 433 number 2. But it's actually, now we know it's number 4. So anyway, that was like the parameters were wide open. Do anything in any amount of time, it just got so open that there are almost no rules anymore. And he dedicates this to Yoko Ono and her husband at the time, Toshi Ishinagi, who was one of Cage's students. So 1958 is also the year that they do a big retrospective for Cage in New York. It's called the 25-year retrospective, and it is not organised by composers. It's organised by two artists and a filmmaker, Robert Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns, and Emile D'Antonio. So this score, Concert for Piano and Orchestra, is sort of the main new work that he had done at that moment. And if you look at that score, it's got a billion different types of scoring within one score, right? Look at all these different graphic models. So this is like a panorama of what Cage would give to the next generation who would pick up his scoring techniques and use them for a whole lot of other things. And those other things began in his class at the New School in New York. So this little section of the room deals with Cage's experimental composition class at the New School in New York. And this is the third version of 433, which he writes in text. He does it at this time for very special reasons. And that is, he's teaching a class of students, and the announcement for the class said you don't need any musical training. That might have been a big mistake, because Cage got a class full of artists. No one knew how to write music. So what was fascinating is they wrote their scores as language, as text, which is going to generate conceptual art. You see, so that's how Cage's score suddenly makes a proposition not only for a piece of music but for a work of art. So all these artists adapted the score and took it into the world of art. Two key figures in his class were Alan Capro and George Brecht. They both made temporal art forms. Brecht made something called the event, which was an object surrounded by time, and Alan Capro made the happening. He invented the happening. So both of these were art plus action plus time plus sound. So this is Cage's sort of first legacy. And speaking of sound, you can hear this very noisy thing behind you, which is Robert Morris's box with the sound of its own making. Morris is in a group of artists with Lamont Young, Henry Flint, and Morris, and basically they're all taking Cajun strategies to a different level. So this box, it's just got how it was made, as a tape recording inside the box. So funnily enough, Robert Morris invited Cage over to his house when he made this in 1961, his loft in New York, and showed it to him. And Cage said, sat down and listened to it for 2 hours. So Robert Morris is saying, oh my God, I did something clever. So anyway, he was very proud that Cage was so interested. On the TV screen behind, just so we don't leave the women out of this picture, Simone Forti was a dancer who took some of the principles of Cage and Lamont Young into dance, and I think she had a lot to do with minimalism in America. She was married to Robert Morris, and she started doing these incredible boxes on stage. And minimalism is about these boxes in space that you move through, right? And it's a treatment of space. So she was sort of, she had these coffin-like boxes with people lying underneath them whistling. And so the boxes looked like they were whistling. And it's this incredible moving thing with the body, with a geometric form, and with the use of space and sound. So this is an amazing moment coming out of Cage when everyone's incredibly inventive. It's poets, it's dancers and artists all at once. This is another thing that came out of the same context, Tree Movie. Cage's big thing was duration. It's the only thing left he had in the score. Like 4:33, all it has is time left, right? So this is a score for a movie it's called Tree Movie. It's got a little asterisk in the score that says if you don't want to use a tree, you can put a mountain or a beach or a flower or something, right? But the thing is that you put the camera on the same thing for 4 hours. He did it, 4 hours of the tree. And he's a concrete poet as well. So you hear him saying, tree, 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 tree. It's very beautiful. It's sort of this meditation on one thing. And just to sort of give Jackson Maclow his real credit, he was an anarchist, and he met Cage, and they both sort of were interested in anarchy together. But Maclow did this unbelievable piece in the middle of the Vietnam War, actually at the very beginning, before anyone knew what napalm was. He stood in Times Square with his newborn baby, and instead of this tree, he said, napalm, napalm, napalm. And people were like, what's napalm? You know, they didn't know what it was. And so it was an unbelievably powerful political piece using concrete poetry. So it sort of generates a lot, right? The other key point about this Tree Movie is if you look in the next gallery, you have Andy Warhol's Empire. Exactly the same idea. But 4 years later. But before I get to Empire, I just want to say something about Fluxus. Fluxus is the other very big thing that comes out of Cage. George Brecht was in his class, and Brecht started writing these event scores. By 1963, he had over 200 scores that were not only scoring music, but scoring objects, chairs, all these other things. So this expands the concept of the score, and these scores became the centre of Fluxus performance. And then all these other artists were writing scores as well. So you have this beautiful one behind you, Thomas Schmidt. It's called Zyklus für Wasserreimer, or de Flaschen, which is cycle for water buckets or bottles. And basically it's this incredible thing about time as well, because he moves around this circle, pouring the water and spilling a bit along the way, and so eventually the water will run out. But it's almost like a Zen meditation as you're going through it. This is the video of 6 minutes we have left, the only thing that exists of the first Fluxus Festival in Wiesbaden. We actually arrived at a great moment. This is Nam June Paik realising someone else's score. The score was written by Lamont Young, very famous scorer. Its instruction is draw a straight line and follow it. And so he does it with paint, dips his head in the paint, runs it across the paper, and renames it Zen for Head. So Fluxus sort of expands the repertoire of the score in the realm of performance. And you see all these beautiful different score strategies. This one's called Keyboard Dances, and it's a box full of hundreds of scrolls, the score being a scroll. This is the little flip book. It's called Disappearing Music for Face. And what it means is it starts with a big smile and it disappears over time. That's a film of it. The artist is called Mieko Shiomi. The person's mouth, who's in the film, is Yoko Ono. So, now from Fluxus, we go on to another important grasp of Cage, which is Nam June Paik. And the TV's working good. So, Cage, as I showed you earlier, wrote this Imaginary Landscape No. 4 score for 12 radios. Paik has a show in Wuppertal in Germany in 1963, and it's using a title very like Cage's. It's called Exposition of Music, Experimental Television. So instead of experimental music, he's converting it to television. So this is like a score. He had all these TVs that you alter, and you transform the image of the TV with a magnet and with many other things. He got into the wiring of the TV, made a single line down the TV, which he called Zen for TV. But the point about this touching the signal of television is also a political point. Television was just beginning its huge rise into dominating our life and our senses and advertising and all this sort of stuff, forcing itself into our living room, right? So if you get to manipulate the signal, you're not being manipulated, you're manipulating. So it's sort of an interesting use of compositional principles against television. I think this is Paik's most radical moment. Later he sells out, gets sponsored by Sony and does a zillion televisions, you know, but at this moment it's very cool. So he does this whole show. On the back wall you have magnetic tape, and it's like what you would have in audio cassettes, right? And this piece is called Random Access. And the people, and you can do it too, you are meant to drag a stylus along the magnetic tape and make your own sound. Similarly with the Schallplatten Schaslicks, it's like a shish kebab of records, and you're meant to sort of run the needle over the record. So it's very participatory. So it's between Cage and Fluxus. The piece right here brings all this together in some sense, because Cage made a piece called Variations 5, where Paik did the televisions in the background. The structural filmmaker Stan Vanderbeek did movies. Merce Cunningham danced. Cage and Tudor did the music. And then it had these little sticks sticking up all through the stage, which are called photocells. When the dancer moved past it, it created sound. So these were made by Billy Kluver, who's a very important engineer at the time. Billy Kluver then goes on to make Warhol's Silver Clouds. So the Silver Clouds, now we see this in the context of Cage, we might just call it a chance composition. It's a thought. You don't have to believe it. So then Cage joins Robert Rauschenberg with Experiments in Art and Technology, and they do a big performance called Nine Evenings in New York, where they get engineers to work with artists to come up with anything that the artists can't do by themselves with technology. It's going to get louder now. So this piece, if you can hear me, was made in 1969, May 1969. Why I'm giving you the month is because it's 1 month before the man lands on the moon, right? And Cage amazingly decides to make a piece with 5,000 slides, many of which are taken from NASA, directly from NASA. And so they're images of the Earth from the moon and vice versa, but only satellite images, because there hadn't been a man on the moon, right? And so then Cage paints his own slides. That's a painted slide. He hand paints some of them, and then the rest are ready-made. And then he uses film footage as well, and 52 reel-to-reel tape recorders. So he makes this explosive, extravaganza, multimedia experience. And he calls it HPSCHD, which is harpsichord. That's a sound you hear. You hear a harpsichord. But the other part is HPSCHD was the term the computer comes up with for harpsichord. And he used computers for 2 years at the University of Illinois to compose the music. So just to let you know that Cage breaks into multimedia. So he's really the father of a lot of contemporary strategies. Here you have the workings out for that piece. So there's computer paper, this old computer paper. This was the days when a computer took up a whole room. 1968, the two old friends, John Cage and Marcel Duchamp, meet up again in the year of Duchamp's death. He dies just a few months later, and they decide to have a chess game, and they call it Reunion. And this chessboard's a very special chessboard because it's wired for sound. And so each move of the game makes a musical composition. And this is the actual chessboard that they used. And it's very funny. Duchamp was an incredible chess player and Cage was okay. So it always had to start with what they called a Duchamp handicap. So this is how we've had to set it up. Anyway, the last piece, I'm not going to talk in there because it's too difficult, but it ends on a political note. You can't call a show The Anarchy of Silence without explaining the anarchy, since we have explained the silence to a certain degree. So Cage was... his later work got very political, very urgently concerned with matters of the world, with environment, with how we were destroying the world, and with how auditory experience was getting destroyed. We're becoming more and more alienated, right? So the lecture on the weather, which is the last piece in there, I'm going to let you go in and enjoy it yourself, but it's a very beautiful, complicated work. It's got weather sounds above, real weather. So you have thunder, lightning, storm, everything. And then at the ear level, it's got people speaking. And they're saying political things. And one of the things that moved me very much, I'm not American, so I'm allowed to say this, it was a time when we'd had two horrible Bush governments when I was choosing the work for this show. And there was one unbelievable line that Cage said, not in the year of his death, but in 1975, he said to the United States and all of those who hate us, may this country one day be just like any other country, no more, no less. So it's this, you know, unbelievably passionate American speaking against his country. So it's very moving work. And the weather here means the political climate, not just the weather. So go and take a listen and think about why Cage transformed everything about composing. He did it to touch bigger things in the world as well. I hope that's what you take away from the show in addition to everything else. Thanks for listening.